This is Monocle on Design, Monocle's weekly design show. I'm Josh Fennett. On today's edition...
And this is what is so enjoyable about teamwork in an office like mine, is that you don't care. You go there and the dance starts.
We speak to the Italian maestro Renzo Piano at the Royal Academy of Arts, where a new retrospective exhibition takes us behind the scenes of his rangy repertoire. Plus,
their fonts, their colours and the shapes they were styled in gave Las Vegas's dens of earthly delights their identities.
We're in Las Vegas to discover how graphic design has shaped and continues to change Sin City's visual identity. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design with me, Josh Fennett. Do stay tuned. Now, it's easy to think you know an architect from their work, especially one as celebrated as Renzo Piano. Even the most disinterested pavement-watching city slickers would recognise at least one of his buildings, and those architecturally minded can speak spiritedly of his accomplishments and controversies, from the inside-out Pompidou Centre to the Shard towering over London and the glassy New York Times building. So what can possibly be gleaned from an exhibition of his project that we don't already know from seeing the finished buildings? If an architect had the opportunity to present their life's work in a new way, what would they want to convey? Well, luckily for us, the Royal Academy of Art has been pondering something very similar. Over the past 2 years, Renzo Piano and Kate Goodwin, head of architecture at the Academy, have been working on a new retrospective that draws on models and sketches from the architect's archive to highlight the work and art that's gone into shaping his many and madly ambitious projects. Before we speak to the architect himself, be patient, that's coming up later in the show. Monocle's Christy Evans met with curator Kate Goodwin for a tour of the exhibition.
Renzo was very keen to present the projects on these tables. There was a number of things that he felt quite strongly about, and it was about one also, as you'll see, there's chairs around all of these tables, and that for him was really important. I think we spent 2 hours one day when I went down to Genoa discussing the chairs, the colour, the number, how people were going to be, and he would sit back and he'd describe it. See, Kate, it's about people coming around together. It's about this sense of being able to relax and enjoy it, that, you know, an exhibition shouldn't be arduous. It should be something you can pause in. You can ponder over material if you want to. You can just take a minute to reflect on what you've seen. And it's sort of the chairs give it that conviviality. It's a sort of informality to how it works. You know, his office, quite tellingly, is called the Renzo Piano Building Workshop. And the workshop is a really important part of it. And also, I think the building workshop is also the spirit of the bottego, which he talks about quite a lot, which is the Italian word for a sort of art studio come workshop.
And I have to say, you know, I was kind of struck by the high ceiling and just the sheer amount of, I mean, it's not entirely natural, but it feels completely natural, the light, and you've got bits of model hanging from the ceiling. It gives it a little bit of texture, and it kind of just feels like I am maybe in his workshop.
That's lovely. That's exactly what we wanted. And so what underlies so much of his work is this desire to kind of defy gravity, to lift heavy objects, buildings from the earth, and to create spaces for people beneath it. And he talks a lot about, he interchanges the word light, lightness, and sometimes talking about natural daylight, because I think it's kind of spirit of the cycle of a day that he really enjoys about natural daylight, but also about lightness, which is defying gravity. And, you know, as he says, you walk in, your eyes rise up and they see these models. And the other part of what these models are, is they're not heavy pieces as well. They're often about structure very often, and he is an architect who's really interested in how you make buildings, actually the process of construction, how they come together. And it's not really about its form, it's about all of those component parts. And he talks about designing a building piece by piece. You know, it's a sum of its parts, and it's created from that small component into something bigger.
And I'm sure our listeners can't help but notice that you've got more than just visuals going on, you've got sound. Tell me what you've incorporated into this.
Well, this really came from Renzo. It was his desire to do something different for this exhibition. And, you know, he's aware of the fact that it's, you know, architecture is always the thing that's outside of the galleries. And how do you start to evoke some of those senses of what it's like to be in a building? And sound was really important for him, so was scent. And so he worked with a composer that he knew and a sound technician. And over a period of a year, they created different sounds for a number of different projects. And we listened to them, were creating them, of sort of understanding how to refine them to get them to be evocative at the particular place. And in the end, there is sound associated with four of the tables. And they're also done on a very subtle sensor system. So as you approach them, they get a little bit louder, the atmosphere comes up. The sound is also transferred through the tabletop itself. So Renzo, when he was designing the tables, really thought about their ability to act as almost as drums, so that it's, the sound is heard, but it's also felt through these tables. For me, it's very close to how he thinks. At one level, he's incredibly practical. He said to me, you know, Kate, I want this exhibition to be scientific and research and all those things. But he also is about the poetry. And so he's always about this very scientific, the science meets the art, the kind of the rational meets the sensation. And I think that spirit's in the show in the same way as well.
And the gallery is laid out quite interestingly. You said earlier that it's almost symmetrical. You've got two wings almost, and then you've got a central point where we have an island and we have a film. So shall we go and take a look at that?
Yeah, let's come into the film in the central room.
Rosso is about traveling, and those ships coming, one comes from China, the other one goes to America. You know, it's so in the mind of a little boy, the harbor is the place of adventure. You start to dream about what happened on the other side of that sea, of running away to discover the rest of the world. This idea of running away is part of the Genoese.
It was a film he commissioned by the German filmmaker called Thomas Radelschmeier. And it's a really lovely piece. We had quite a long conversation actually about how to create a film in a room which is, it's four-directional. There, at the heart of it is also an island, which is a central space. So people will never be, they'll be seeing it as an installation and feeling it as an installation rather than as a sort of traditional film with a start and an end. And he was keen to really bring, it was a way of bringing Renzo's voice into the show, you know, that the spirit. And he talks so brilliantly and beautifully about architecture. I think there's very few people I've met who can talk actually as inspiringly as Renzo does. And it's really nice to have those things, and you know, there's some quite personal scenes of, as you would have seen, it's him sailing a boat he designed, and there's that lovely moment where he just loves being on the water, and that spirit of enjoyment there, you kind of really get a sense of who he is as a person through the film.
Instantly you could see this sort of childlike love of the world and of building from the film, and when you put that together with his work, everything suddenly starts clicking into place.
I could say it's a little bit of, this is the way in which the galleries were structured with this room in the middle, but the more we thought about it, the more perfect it was, because it's quite nice to sort of come across the building, start with him. The first room has eight of his buildings from what he calls his prehistory, so it's before the Pompidou Centre, then the Pompidou Centre and the Manil Collection, which is the first building he really did, sort of, he got the commission in 1981. You know, it was his first major commission under his own name and with his new practice. You're seeing some of his work, sort of eight projects, and then you come across him. And I think it's quite a nice thing, because then it starts to make sense of what you've seen, and I think you come into this second room and then see the next eight projects quite differently in a sort of informed way. And, you know, because quite often films end up being at the end of the show, and then you're like, oh no, it all starts to make sense. But I kind of really like this moment here where you're thrown into it, buildings first, man, then buildings again, and it kind of creates this lovely thread and tie through it all. Renzo, when we first sat down, and he had a plan of the galleries laid out, and he had all the tables, and he said, ah, people will do this, and he got his signature green pen out, and he did these lovely curving shapes wandering all around between, he kind of described it like exploring an archipelago, you know, islands in an archipelago. You go around here, you go through here, you go back on yourself. So he really did envisage people doing that.
And let's move on to talk about the island now. I really loved it because it just made me remember this geography project I had to do once, where we had to take like an ordnance survey map and basically build a 3D version. And that just sort of, to me, it was like an inverse of that. You had that underneath, and then there was a lot of texture, let's put it that way. And it just looked like that he'd built his perfect island with his buildings.
Yeah, absolutely. I think your response to it is perfect. I mean, he'd be delighted to hear you say that, because he thought, you know, this was, I think it's about a year and a half in the making, in firstly the designing, then thinking about like the details on it, the materiality of it, the carving of it. There was a number of different prototypes, and something he does with everything. He prototypes everything at a one-to-one scale. That's how you test materials. That's how you really understand how it comes together. And at one point, the top of the island was all this smooth grey sort of plastery thing, and then he realised it actually wanted texture, wanted contours, as you say, like an audience survey map. You'll have seen, I think, probably your response to that was also the grid line on there. It really was. He kind of liked the idea of the map and that sense of exploration. There was also a pretty big conversation about how many buildings to be on there. And it's sort of, there was 50, there was 60. And every time I go down to Genoa, I was going down every month, there'd be another couple. And so then there's one point it went up to 80. And then he was like, actually, no, we pulled it back to 60. And so every time it was this thing that he would just dream about and think about. And the other thing, this is kind of very early on, when he was talking about ideas, and I don't know, it was something that he spoke more about probably a while ago. But it's very much about, he talks about architecture and indeed life like an iceberg. You know, architecture is what one sees that's built. There is always the great depths beneath the sea of the iceberg that one never sees. You know, we just get the tip of the iceberg when we get the building here. And, you know, when I look at the model, I also sort of see that iceberg.
The one thing I think I've taken away from this, from seeing everything together and seeing that film, is how much he loves his home, the islands, and that's clearly his happy place, and how much that contrasts the world he's built. You know, these great grand skyscrapers, these big buildings that have completely changed the landscape in so many urban environments. I don't know what to make of that. I think I'm still processing it.
I think that is, you know, particularly for people who only know the Shard, you know, it's a big, in some ways, corporate, you know, building. Everyone has their relationship or thoughts about it. It's a glass tower. But there are a lot of things in that building that break down scale, which fracture it so it looks more human. He's always interested in public space, and there's a series of different public spaces in that sort of building, despite it being a, you know, completely private building. And I think that you do get some of those. I mean, I find it is surprising, you know, the variety of the work and that spirit that you talk about that sort of becomes evident in the central room. You start to see it in all of these projects. And there's kind of, you know, something like Pathé, which is here in front of us. It's quite fun. It's unexpected in what it does. It's this sort of blobby, strange building which goes in this kind of infill space in quite a tight 18th century arrondissement in Paris, you know, with surrounded by much older buildings. And you know, there's often sort of a playful curiosity in the work. And he enjoys life. I think that was the other sort of thing that, in what you were saying, that you got the sense of how much he enjoys life and how much he loves architecture. And that kind of love comes out with, I think, how he designs the buildings and cares for the buildings and hopes that people will enjoy them. You know, they're not something that he just does and puts up, walks away from, never sees again. He goes back to a number of the projects in New York, as he's got other things there, just checking up on them, seeing how they're weathered, how people are using them. Because that's, you know, you can conceive and design a building as much as you like in your head. It's when it becomes used, becomes part of the grain of the city, that's when it takes on its real life.
And one final thing that I've just noticed in the whole of the gallery is that at either end we have pictures with basically a circle of people, no building, just people. And for me, that shows me that his buildings don't centre around himself and his work, but the people that are going to use them afterwards.
Yep, it's beautiful, isn't it?
This idea of running away is part of the Genoese nature. You know, Genoa is a kind of powerful city, but always very fragile.
Many thanks to this show's ever-patient editor. It's Christy Evans, speaking there to Kate Goodwin. Renzo Piano, The Art of Making Buildings, is on at London's Royal Academy of Arts until January 2019. Shortly, we'll bring you that long-mooted interview with architect Renzo Piano. I know you can't wait, but first for a quick aside. There is one US city that is arguably defined more by typefaces that are dotted along its facades and thoroughfares than any other. Las Vegas, of course. As America's original Sin City, Vegas's neon signs, its hotels, wedding chapels, motels, and other arenas of earthly delights, salubrious or otherwise, continue to define this corner of the states. Monocle's Toronto bureau chief absconded from his desk for reasons unknown and ended up on the slots at Caesar's Palace. He also saw fit to find time to unpick the city's graphic design heritage and how it's changing today.
Few cities have evoked the kind of cultural totems like Elvis Presley's crooning 1963 tribute there, and Las Vegas has, since it established itself as the purveyor of a particular brand of American joie de vivre in the first quarter of the 20th century. And as the tourists came in increasing numbers to sample the thrills, cheap or otherwise, available here, its institutions realised that they needed to peddle their wares. And what better way to do it than through the signs above their thresholds?
Come get the best of the USA. Come out and play the American way. The stars by night, the sun by day. It's the American way.
My name is Tracy Sprigg, and I am the collections manager at the Neon Museum.
The Neon Museum, founded in the 1990s, lies a stone's throw away from downtown Las Vegas, the cradle of the city's neon identity. The museum is a repository for the neon signs that for decades defined their corners of the city, and in their fonts, their colours and the shapes they were styled in gave Las Vegas's dens of earthly delights their identities.
We know for sure that neon starts reaching the shores of the United States around the early to mid-1920s. The first lease on the West Coast, since we're talking about us over here on the West Coast, would have been California, either in San Francisco or Los Angeles, probably around 1923 to 25 or so. So it doesn't take long for it to start pushing in closer into Las Vegas. And so by 1928 or so is when we have our first neon sign here in the city. It was downtown on Fremont. It was the Overland Hotel down in Fremont. And then from there, it just kind of kept going. I like to kind of refer to it as a case of the Joneses, so to speak, as that everybody kind of wanted to do something bigger and better than their neighbor.
I love the laughs and love the life. There's fun of every kind. Next time I come, I'll bring my wife. I'll do that if I lose my mind. A wife in Vegas takes...
Perhaps the most famous of the signs is the totem designed to welcome visitors to the city that reads, "Welcome to Fabulous Las Vegas." It was designed by one of the few women working in graphic design in Las Vegas, Betty Willis.
Betty Willis is well known for having designed the Welcome to Fabulous Las Vegas sign, a sign that she, oddly enough, thought was not going to last that long. She figured it would be only up maybe 10 or 15 years. But I think in Betty Willis's case, when she came into the industry, she happened to just kind of hit the mark at the right time. When she was in college or going to art school, it was during the war, and so by the time she got out of school and was working commercial print work, the war was still going on. So by the time she was able to kind of move into the inside industry, she already had plenty of experience and time just kind of shifting into it. In one of the oral histories we do have with Betty Willis, she said that she was really one of the only women that she knew in the industry at that time. There was only one other woman that she knew of that worked at Electrical Products in Los Angeles. And other than that particular woman, she didn't really work with any other women.
And when, for example, she was designing the Welcome to Fabulous Las Vegas sign, you know, what did that commission kind of look like? And, you know, what were some of her sort of driving goals, I suppose, or like the way she was forming her aesthetic kind of vocabulary, I guess, and how they filtered into the sign that is probably one of the most famous city signs in the world by this stage?
You know, it's funny, like I said earlier with Betty Willis, when she designed that sign, it was done a commission. I think it was the county who commissioned it. It was kind of just a piece to welcome people into the city. And like she said multiple times in multiple interviews, she never assumed it was going to be a long-lasting piece. She assumed it would be up maybe a few years and they were going to take it down and replace it. But, you know, it definitely is, I think, a sign of the time from when it was built. You know, it definitely has those kind of googly and mid-century elements to it, like the star and then the kind of diamond shape with the kind of, you know, with that edging around it. And I think she was just kind of probably inspired by just general, like, things in Las Vegas, because the little circles where the welcome are, those are actual, that's change, those are coins. So slot machines, obviously there probably was some inspiration with that there. But, yeah, I think she was just probably struck at that moment and, you know, did her design and didn't probably think much of it until much later. I mean, she wasn't even really recognized for being the designer of that welcome sign until much later in her life.
I love Vegas every moment. It's my favorite atmosphere.
But as technology changes and institutions in Las Vegas opt for LED screens, for example, instead of the artistry of the signage pioneered by Betty Willis and her peers, and as the appetites of tourists coming to Las Vegas shift too, the most recognizable part of Las Vegas's visual identity is gradually taking on another form.
Neon hasn't necessarily gone away here in the city, I think. I don't think people are aware that there are ordinances and requirement in downtown Las Vegas that still require neon on buildings in that area. So we will always probably be known as a neon city, but definitely technology is changing things. There's nothing wrong with progress, and I think that obviously this is a natural change, and it's just like every other change that's happened here in the city. You know, it's the newest and the biggest and the best new thing that is going on, and it kind of is what it is.
For Monocle, I'm Thomas Lewis.
Many thanks to Monocle's Toronto Bureau Chief Thomas Lewis, who is reporting there from Las Vegas. Now at long last, back to our sit-down with the Italian architect Renzo Piano at London's Royal Academy of Art. He started by explaining why he's still surprised every time he completes a project.
I get surprised myself. You know, it's not just me. Everybody gets surprised. I know many, many writers that are surprised about the phrase that they just made, you know. Oh, that's me? Sometimes you're surprised. And this is starting very soon in life, you know, the first time, there's a first time for that. When you are 8 years old, 9, 10 years old, and for the first time in your life you do something that works, then you watch what you've done. And maybe a phrase, maybe a little song, or maybe a little object, and happily somebody around you, maybe your mother, your father, your brother, sister, comes and say, oh, well done, and then you are surprised. But that's me, I made this. I'm still like that now, still like that. I mean, you do things and then you are surprised. It's because, of course, it's not you, just you. You're surprised because you working with other people, you come up with something that makes sense. And this is the secret of teamwork. This is the secret of teamwork. I mean, this is something that is unique, and I think you needed that kind of innocence to keep. And somebody said that it takes a long time to become a child in life, and I think this is quite true.
How do you feel about London as a city? Obviously, you've got one of the most emblematic buildings of the city that you've designed right here.
So many buildings, what you prefer, what you know, it's difficult to say. I mean, when you look at those things, they are all children in some way, and it's difficult. You normally take more care of the youngest, so you are very close to the ones that are still going on, you know, but this is one of the problems, and that you have so many children around the world, and you are worried about their lives and if they are happy or not.
And you want to visit them as often as you can?
Yes, of course. I visit, I care. It's like children. You are worried. And you know, buildings like children are happy sometimes, sometimes not happy. Because buildings need love, not just your love. And thanks God, when you make a public building, they become almost ever, they become a place for people that people love because they become part of their lives. So when you make a museum, a university, a school, a church or whatever, a library, those buildings enter in the kind of ritual of the city and they become part of the life of people. So Beaubourg in Paris took a long time, but now it's part of Paris. It's part of the life of many people. And then that's why those buildings are normally more loved than private buildings, because they belong to the community.
And what about the value, in your opinion, of architectural exhibitions such as this one? I mean, obviously it's quite different from an art exhibition, but what do you think the value is, both for the people that come to see the exhibition, but also for the architects such as yourselves? Do you gain something out of it as well?
I was a bit surprised when we offered to make an exhibition at the Royal Academy, because architecture is not really about art. It's more like construction and community and society. But this is not true, because in reality architecture is art as well. And of course it's about construction, it's about the poetry of construction, it's about community, because you make building for people, for community, to create a city, a better place to live. But you know, such kind of message, it's almost like watching in the iceberg, you know, not only the visible part of the iceberg, but also the invisible part of the iceberg. Without that invisible part, that is 9 times bigger than the visible part, you don't see the rest. So this is what is quite subtle in this exhibition, and that's why making this exhibition at the Royal Academy, in a museum that is about art, makes sense. Because, you know, at the end, you feel that you need art, you need poetry, you need beauty in some way to reach people emotionally.
And you're right, the exhibition really does make a lot of the artifacts that you made use of visible to us, you know, what's behind all your projects. And I noticed a lot of your hand-drawn sketches, which are, of course, instantly recognizable to many of us. Is it true that a lot of these are sketched as part of your meetings that you have in your studio, and then your colleagues quickly scan them, and then you kind of use those as a reference point?
Yes, but it's not my merit. If the exhibition does this miracle, it's because it's been well done by the Royal Academy, by the curator, by Kate Goodwin, by the other people, by people in my office. I mean, this work is a long work. I think we started 3 or 4 years ago, something like that. It takes time.
What's your day-to-day routine like now in your studio in Paris, for example? Do you have daily meetings with your team?
Life is very simple. I go, I don't know what I have to do. I go to the office, I step in the office. As soon as I cross the threshold, everybody comes to me. And this is what is so enjoyable about the teamwork and an office like mine, is that you don't care. You go there and the dance starts. And you never stop. Up to when you go to home. And next morning you start again. So it's kind of, you know, teamwork is like that. I mean, you become part of, it's like a dance, and never stopping dance.
Renzo Piano there, speaking to Monocle's Daphne Karnesis about the exhibition at the Royal Academy of the Arts. And sadly, that's all we have time for on this week's show. And if that wasn't enough design inspiration for you, don't forget, we publish libraries worth of books, a monthly magazine, and more newspapers than you can shake a stick at for inspiration. Do head to monocle.com/subscribe to be part of the fun. Monocle on Design was produced by Daphne Karnesis and edited by the ever-patient Christy Evans. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.